Welcome to the third series of the HE Knowledge Hub podcast, brought to you by Next Step Southwest, or NSSW. In this series, we're going to be collaborating with fellow UniConnect Humber Outreach Programme, or HOP. They cover parts of Yorkshire and Lincolnshire, and they're led by the University of Hull. We're joined up to bring you unique conversations from industry experts, which have been really insightful as we've had the opportunity to dive deeper into certain aspects of higher education and job sectors. We'll be talking about how to develop crucial skills, different interview processes, whilst highlighting different industries. In this first episode, we're going to be delving deeper into the subject of interviews, a prospect that can be daunting for us all throughout our lives. We'll be looking at different aspects of interviews, from a standard discussion to presenting a portfolio, and then we'll join our colleagues at HOP for a chat about how to approach auditions. In this first conversation, I speak with Julia Ward, who has many years' experience in helping primarily young people find the confidence to present themselves to the best of their abilities. Here are Julia's expert tips for how to look at interviews differently and hopefully never fear them again. Julia has worked with Next Step Southwest for many years, delivering some outstanding sessions to support students' confidence to speak and present in public. So, Julia, what is it that makes you uniquely qualified to offer advice on interviews?
I think really my background, I started working with young people. At that point, it was only young people, 16 to 18 year olds. And I spent my whole time working with them to increase their confidence in speaking and interview skills, to get them to sell themselves in the best way that they possibly could. I've spent many years teaching, but always in communication. And when I set up my company with my partner, Ali Shora, many years ago, which was a company called Articulacy, we focused on giving people confidence in communicating. And that is what an interview needs. You need to be confident at your interview. You need to be able to speak at your interview and sell yourself in the best way that you possibly can. So I've just been doing it for a long time, Sophie, and experience counts for a lot, which is why when you're 16, 17, 18, it's always great to listen to lots of different people. I'm only one person. There are loads of other points of view out there.
Is there a difference between an interview for a job, for example, compared with an interview for an HE course at university or college?
Every interview you go to, regardless of what it's for, will be different. But for any interview you go for, you have to prepare for it. So the preparation process is very similar. Whether you're going to go for an HE interview or a job interview, you need to have a basic understanding of what it is you're applying for. And so the research that you do is going to stand you in very good stead. And I think the really important thing to remember in all of this, it doesn't matter what you're going for, is you don't have to be perfect. You just have to show people that you are suitable and keen to do whatever it is you're applying to do.
Great advice, because yes, of course, none of us have actually done what we're being interviewed for already, or very, very rarely have we already done it. I suppose in recent years, we've gotten very used to things moving on to online. Is there a difference between a face-to-face interview and an online?
I think there can be a huge difference. You have to psych yourself up and be in an appropriate frame of mind. And so if you're going to, even for an online interview, people can see you. So dress appropriately from the bottom to the top, or the top to the bottom. Make sure you're sitting in a neat and tidy area. I've worked a lot and interviewed a lot with people online, and I was absolutely shocked at the debris that was around them. And this, to me, is a guide as to what these people are like. If I can see them sitting surrounded by mess, does that mean that they are naturally quite a messy person? And that's all going to form my opinion of them. The other big problem with Zoom interviews, that type of interview, or it can be a problem if you don't learn how to work with it, is that we are all very self-conscious. We're all very image conscious. And so I very often see people checking themselves out during a conversation. People will check their hair, their makeup, the angle of their glasses or whatever, and actually lean in towards the camera and look at themselves. It is super off-putting. And I'll tell you what's a really good way of dealing with that is actually cover up the bit or change the view so that you can't see yourself, and then practice talking directly, eye contact into the camera. It feels weird because what happens is you are now not looking at yourself, and you're probably not looking at the person on the screen, but to the person on the screen, you appear as if you are making eye contact. And these things are really, really important when you're being interviewed. And of course, then the body language, when you're face to face with somebody, there's so much more of their of your body language that they can see. And you can see theirs as well, for that matter. It's a two-way process always. So, yes, I think there's a big difference in an interview one way or the other.
What sort of impression should you aim to give? How can you sort of come across as a bit more confident maybe than you feel?
Fake it till you make it. It can be very intimidating walking into a room for an interview, but you can fake it. And the way you fake it is through your body language. This is how you appear confident. And it is by walking tall. And by that, I mean not hunching your shoulders, not leaning into yourself. It's walking tall. It's by making eye contact, whether there's one person in the room or three or four people in the room, you make eye contact with them all. It's by smiling. Smiling is so important. And it's one of the things that we do actually forget to do, particularly when we're nervous. And all of those things give the impression that we're confident. And there's this very famous woman who's an expert on body language, and her name is Amy Cuddy. And you can find loads of her on YouTube TED Talks. And she says this thing: your body changes your mind changes your behavior changes your outcome. Your body can trick you into feeling more confident. And so that's the key. And you can do that both online and face-to-face. Stand tall, smile, make eye contact, and you will appear confident, and they will be attracted to you as a person because you are appearing that way. It's a great start.
If that goes by the wayside and you're in an interview and you feel the nerves taking over, or you feel it's not going to plan, or you're not coming up with the answers that seem right, what can you do to find a calmness and a sort of confidence? Is there anything you can do in that situation?
Well, I think it's really important to remember that the interviewer is there to see the best of you, and actually they're on your side. They're not there to trick you. They don't want to catch you out. And so if you say to somebody, look, I'm really sorry, but I'm incredibly nervous and I feel that I could improve my answers in some way. Can we go back over this point, or can we go back over that point, or could you give me a chance to talk about this? They will say yes, because actually they want to know about you. They want to learn more about you, and they are looking in the end for the best fit for their course, their company, their job, whatever it is you've gone for. They're looking for the best fit. And just by telling them with that little element of honesty how you are feeling at that point shows them that you've got initiative. It's a good start. The person interviewing, frankly, will know. They'll be able to tell if you're nervous. And if you can just acknowledge that, they will also know that if this person is working for me, and for some reason they don't understand this or they can't cope with that, then they're going to come and tell me. And that's what they need to know. They don't want somebody waffling their way through and pretending that everything's okay when it's not. I think it's always good to work on the side of honesty is the best policy.
We talked earlier about types of question and whether students know if there are types of question that might be asked in an interview. Can you shed some light on those?
Yeah, there very much are types of questions. So what people want to know when you're being interviewed is they don't only want to know about your skills, but they also want to know about your values and your attitudes. So they ask different types of questions. They're called behavioural questions. So they will give you a question to get an example of how you might choose to behave in a certain situation. So, for example, with a younger person, they might say, if you witnessed somebody being bullied at school, how did you respond? What did you do? They might ask you how you work under pressure. They might give you a case question. So they'll give you a situation and ask how you would manage it, a specific working situation. That's probably more of a job one than a course one. And of course, you've got the good old competency-based questions, which are literally finding out what you can do. And I must go back all the time when you're being asked, can you do this or how do you do that? Just remember that you can't do everything. You just can't do everything. You are not going to be 100%. No one will be 100% perfect for the role. They just want the best fit for their company. And your personality, your confidence, how you sell yourself, how you communicate, how you make eye contact, how you smile, how you present yourself, all of that is going to have this massive impact upon how they feel about you at the end of the interview.
We all have quite high standards, but actually those sort of notions of perfection are perhaps something that we project ourselves. The interviewers aren't necessarily expecting that of us. So we can kind of step back, take a deep breath and say, it's okay, I can be myself.
We are without doubt our own worst critics. Yeah. Self-sabotage the whole time. Half the time we'll turn up somewhere and already talk to ourselves out of it before we get there. It just depends what our own opinion of ourselves is. I've got this phrase, which is, I can do it. And I say it to myself, but I don't just say, I can do it. I say, I can do it. I can do it. I can do it. And I just say it lots and lots of times. And I pump myself up because we all suffer with self-doubt. There's nobody that doesn't suffer with self-doubt at some point or another. This internal dialogue can absolutely paralyze us if we're not careful. So change, if you have that internal dialogue, please, I'm asking you now, change it. Change it and give yourself every opportunity you can, because you are good enough and you can do it.
Yes, that's sort of similar to the advice that I've given to students who are writing their personal statement as well. Actually, sell yourself. Nobody else is going to do it for you. Be your own champion, because sometimes younger people don't necessarily feel like they can. You know, they're overly modest, and you sort of find in life that no one else is going to be your cheerleader. You have to do it yourself sometimes. So
you do. And often, you know, when we're very young and growing up, you'll be told not to show off. And so you start to go into yourself and think, okay, well, I won't say that anymore. But you know you can do it. You know very well you can do it. And the fact is, at an interview, you do need to showcase your talents. There's no question. And it's not showing off. What it is just telling people what you can do.
With that in mind, would there be any benefit, do you think, to practicing and preparing for certain questions in advance?
I think there's always value in practicing. And one of the big things that I always say to people is you need to practice out loud. We are all very, very good at conversations inside our heads. We are all articulate inside our heads. We can all argue a brilliant case inside our heads. But the second we're in a situation where we're potentially nervous with somebody who might be overwhelming us a little bit for whatever reason, we lose those words. So you need to practice out loud. Just get someone to go through the questions with you. However, there is a slight warning attached to this. And if you practice questions to the point where you're kind of almost learning them off by heart, it can be slightly dangerous, because The first thing that might happen is you sound as if you're just speaking by rote, and that's not very interesting. But the other thing that might happen is if you forget slightly what it is you meant to say, you can throw yourself during an answer. So when you practice an answer, practice it in lots of different ways, but vocalize it. Say it out loud. Practice, practice, practice out loud. Anybody to ask you anything. Get around the dinner table. If you sit and eat food with people, just get them to chuck random questions at you, no matter how stupid they are. Get them to do it so that you just feel prepared for it.
When I had to begin doing presentations, you know, like most people, you write things on cards and you clutch them as if your life depended on these cards. But very quickly, I thought, as you said, if I deviate from this card, then I feel like I'm lost. Well, actually, I know all the stuff in here anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And if you're talking about yourself, you do know yourself. Don't want to feel that you're doing it wrong when actually you can't do it wrong because it's all come from you in the first place. Like, I've forgotten my lines. You don't want it to seem like lines, do you?
You don't want to. There's only one question out of all the questions that for some reason catches people out. And when I've worked with postgrad students, it's always the first one I ask, and it is quite simply, tell me about yourself. It's a horrible question. And it's a horrible question because really, when you ask that question, it's such a huge subject. And the response that I've had many, many times from people is, what do you want to know? And I tell them, you can tell me anything you want. And so if you were asked that question, ask yourself, how would I answer it? And the answer to that is you're going to answer it differently depending on what it is you're going for an interview for. So, for example, if you're going for an interview or I don't know, you're going to go and you want to do a childcare qualification, for example, it might be appropriate to say, well, I've got 5 siblings and I look after them and I've done loads of babysitting in my spare time. And I feel all that has really, really helped me to choose the type of career that I'm going for because I've learned that I love working with them and I'm very good. And I don't just work with my siblings. I work with my friends, children, however, whatever you do. I mean, obviously I'm making that up on the spot. It's really important. That same answer is going to be completely inappropriate for somebody who wants to become a computer technician. You have to answer the question appropriately, and it is one that gets asked, so it's a great one to practice.
I'm thinking about all the interviews that I've ever had in my life. Usually the panel end with, do you have any questions for us? What's your advice when it comes to this part?
Let's assume that whatever it is you're applying for is a long-term prospect for you, or you would like it to be a long-term prospect for you. You might ask them what where they could see you in 5 years' time, assuming, because quite often that's a question you will be asked by an employer, but what about you asking them that same question? Where do you see me in 5 years' time? Let's assume I've achieved everything that you have set for me. What will my progression be like during my time with you? Do you see me being able to take a role of supervisor at some point, of a manager at some point? That type of question. And it shows them that you're looking at long term, that you're going to be committed. That type of question is always a good question. Ask them, is there anything that they would expect from you in terms of outside of the job role, what sort of things do they look for staff to contribute towards the company in terms of whether it's a social event, it's a charity fundraising event? Do they have other things that they expect staff to take part in? That might be one worth asking. Check out, like I said, do your research on the company. I've noticed you've got a very interesting green policy. How does that apply within recycling within the company? I can only come up with these things once you've done your research.
I think that's crucial advice, isn't it? When you start looking at what they do and these, yes, outside expectations, it might fuel your thoughts and questions will arise from the research that you do. So, yeah, that's super advice.
And the other thing, Sophie, that I personally have always done during an interview, and I know not everybody does it, I've always taken a pen and notepad with me, and I've said to them, do you mind if I make notes? Because what happens during an interview is they say something and you think, I'd like to ask about that. And then by the time you've gone 10 minutes, like, you've forgotten everything about it. And I just say, oh, you said at this point, reflective listening, you said at this point, that's a good reflective question. This, that, or the other happens. Can I just check what you meant by that, or something along those lines? It shows that you're listening. It shows that you're conscientious, that you're prepared to take a note and all the rest of it. I personally, it doesn't suit everyone, that.
And I suppose it would be a little like what you mentioned earlier. It gives them the impression of what you would be like as an employee or a student, that actually, if you didn't understand something, you would be prepared to double check, to find out, to inquire further, rather than sort of hoping that you can fudge your way through it. That is what has come across for me in our conversation. Actually, what you're trying to do is give them an impression of what a relationship, either in an organization or doing a course with you, would be like, how you would behave in that role.
I think that's great. That's a really great way of summing it up. It's not just about, can you do the job? It's about much more than that. It's about the whole you and whether the whole you fits within. It's no good if you've got the skills if you haven't got everything else.
I have to say that I find Julia's advice really relevant. It's made me look at interviews differently, especially the part about double checking the question to clarify, for example, which in fact shows the interviewers how you'd operate, and that's a positive thing. Our next discussion with Jamie Halton, who works at Arts University Plymouth. He's a photography graduate himself, so his first-hand experience of creating a portfolio. As Jamie says, AUP don't do interviews, but base course offers solely on application and portfolio. So it really is a big deal. And what better way to evidence yourself as an artist than with a portfolio?
So Jamie works in student recruitment and events at Arts University Plymouth, and I'm sure he's answered the questions I'm about to ask him about portfolios for many potential students at open and applicant events.
My name's Jamie Halton. I work in student recruitment at Arts University Plymouth. And before that, I was actually a student of photography at Arts University Plymouth. But basically, my job means I go around to lots of different schools and colleges and UCAS fairs and basically just chat to applicants about what their options are and about how to actually go through the uni application process.
Fantastic. So you are absolutely the right person to talk to about this. First question, do all arts courses require students to put together a portfolio in addition to everything else they'll be doing in their application?
Generally, yeah. And I can only really speak for us, but generally I would say about 90% of arts courses will require a portfolio. The ones you'll find which might not are normally the more kind of critical studies courses. So, for instance, a course that we offer is film studies, and we don't require a portfolio for that. But generally, you should expect to be asked for a portfolio for an arts degree.
And actually, perhaps I should have asked this question first. What is a portfolio?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. It can take a lot of different kind of forms. But generally, the way that we describe it is that a portfolio is a collection of your work which evidences who you are as an artist and how you think, but also, really, really key point, how that's changed over time. So it evidences your creative journey.
So at what part in the application process would you submit the portfolio? And does it go straight to the university or college you're applying to, or via UCAS, or how does that all work?
Yeah, again, it sort of depends on the uni. For us, we sort of ask for your portfolio sort of as soon as reasonably possible after your application. So actually, our deadline for portfolio submission is actually at the time of record. So today is the 27th of Feb. So it's actually tomorrow, the 28th of Feb. that doesn't mean that if you're listening to this in a week's time, you know, it's all over and you've got to wait till 2024 now. What it does just mean is that you'll go through a slightly different process. And yeah, we'd normally ask for your portfolio as soon as you can, but generally a week or two after you've applied.
Is it still a physical portfolio that you are sending off, or are there digital elements, or can it be purely digital now?
Yeah, a really good question. So we ask for a purely digital portfolio. However, if you want to submit a physical one, you absolutely can. So generally we do digital, but if you're a really kind of physical person, you want to bring in, you know, maybe you're doing textile design or you've made some sculptures or something, you can bring that to us if you want to, yeah.
I suppose that would be really advantageous for potential students if they're applying to more than one place. You know, it's not sending off something physical to, you know, you can send the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I used to work, when I was a student, I was a student ambassador, and I used to work our interview days, and you just see these people showing up with, you know, these massive kind of A2 art portfolios. I'm sure you know the big plastic things that I'm talking about, just lugging them on the train from, you know, halfway across the country. You know, that's great if you want to do that, but digital is a lot more convenient for a lot of people.
We've touched on it a little bit. Arts courses cover such a variety and breadth, but what could you include potentially in a portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much absolutely anything. So it could be your own work that you've made at school or college, and that could be, you know, photography or film or paintings or illustrations or comics or even actually writing. We have people include little, you know, little scribbles that they've put down alongside their work. It can also be work, and actually this is really advantageous to put in a portfolio, is work that you've done in your spare time, because obviously that shows that it's not just a subject for you, it's something that you've got a real passion for. And something a lot of people don't realize they can include is actually inspiration. So as long as you make it really obvious that it's not your work, then you can include other people's work and say, you know, this is something that I find really interesting and it inspired me. Maybe even better, you could put it next to a piece of work that you made in homage to it, you know.
So, I mean, the process of putting together a portfolio, we're hoping that students aren't sort of faced with the, oh, wow, I've got to do a whole portfolio. You've touched on it, saying that it's stuff that you've already done and it's showing a journey. So what is that process like? Was it sort of like a narrative? Does it have a beginning, middle, end?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, as you say, the good thing is normally people will have some work to start with. And what we really want to see is the whole kind of creative process. So we kind of start with kind of a really basic idea. So if you're a photographer, you might say, okay, I'm really interested in architectural photography. And then you do some kind of experimentation where you just go out and shoot and kind of see what happens. And then you come back and you kind of objectively, you know, basically decided what went well and what you want to do in the future. And then finally, you come to this kind of, you know, final piece of work that you include in the portfolio. Ideally, we want to see something that evidences each kind of step of that in the portfolio, because, of course, it's not just a portfolio which is designed to show, you know, kind of how great you are as an artist. It's kind of actually designed to show how suited you are for an undergraduate degree. And part of that is that kind of objective, critical process, you know.
Of your own process, I guess, like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Show your workings.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah.
So would it be true to say that, I guess, if you're following a project from inspiration to sort of outcome, you could explore a particular theme, or do people have different sort of avenues within one portfolio that is brought
it's great
together?
It's great to show a really wide variety of ideas and different disciplines and mediums. But actually, if you are really interested or passionate about one particular aspect of art, I think it's totally fine and actually pretty natural to have a bias towards that. I would say try not make your portfolio just one idea. But it's fine if you're, you know, really passionate about something to focus on that, I'd say.
Once you've submitted your portfolio and, you know, hopefully you get called for an interview, is there a part of the interview, I'm racking my brains to see if I can remember this, it was a long time ago, where they actually ask you questions or discuss and critique the portfolio, the work that you've submitted?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing I will preface that with is that actually we don't do interviews here anymore. And you might find that that's a bit of a pattern. But if you are invited to an interview, or it might be called a portfolio discussion or an informal chat, something like that. Yeah, I mean, they're going to be asking about your inspirations and your interests and what kind of art you like to work with. And they're probably inevitably, you know, going to chat about your portfolio. And actually, that's probably a benefit. That's probably that's something to look forward to rather than something to dread. Because you can kind of show your work rather than just having to talk about it.
So in terms of the application process at Arts University Plymouth, are they replacing interviews? What's the process now?
So it's actually just totally digital portfolio, and that's right. That generally for most students. But if the student wants a discussion, or if the lecturer feels that it will be beneficial, then sometimes it happens, yeah. And if you do want to bring it in physically, then there will be a discussion about it, you know.
So the portfolio is, I mean, it's hugely important. It is the main thing, really, alongside your application.
Yeah, absolutely. It is extremely important, yeah.
I'm assuming that you have put together a portfolio at some point. And what did you personally find the most challenging about doing that? And what advice would you give someone who's going through that process now?
So the most difficult part of making a portfolio I found, and actually from speaking to students about their portfolios, I think it's fairly common as well, is actually just consolidating it down to a reasonable amount of pieces of work. So you probably only really want to include 20 to 30 pieces of work, and actually probably a bit less than that, really. Obviously quality is better than quantity. I think when I submitted my portfolio for my degree, I think I had 12 photographs in there. And obviously, when you've been shooting for a fair few years, or you've been making art for a fair few years, you know, that's not a lot. So the most difficult thing is just to get it down to that amount of pieces. And the best thing you can do is actually, and it sounds, you know, easier said than done, but it's just to try and remove yourself from the equation and just view the artwork as if it's not yours, basically. And somebody's just laid it in front of you and said, you know, what do you think about this? And, you know, try and think about it as objectively as possible, and just think about its key kinds of, you know, strengths and what you like about it, you know.
Another element to an interview for perhaps a performing arts course might be an audition. Rachel Hopp had a chat with Sophie Clare, an actor based in Hull, about her experiences of auditions and how to find jobs outside London.
Today, I am interviewing Sophie Clare, who is an actress and is actually based in Hull, which is in the Humber region, for anyone that's listening a bit further afield. And we're going to have a chat about auditions. So thank you so much for joining me today.
No problem.
You hear constantly about you need to kind of be in London in order to make it as an actress or an actor or whatever. And you've obviously stuck at kind of staying in Hull. Has that like ever impacted you, or are you happy you've stayed here regardless?
I would almost go as far to say a slight myth that you have to be in London to succeed as an actor. Mm-hmm. There are many actors based all over the country. There's potentially a lot more opportunities and maybe I'd like to say less competition for those opportunities. Not all work exists in London, and in fact, you know, you're available then to go touring, to do whatever it is that sort of comes your way. Financially as well, there's a benefit to being up north rather than, you know, based in London, paying high stuff, meaning that you're having to work these extra jobs and not allowing being able to have enough time to look for auditions, for prepping for other work.
What's the process for you in terms of auditioning first, or finding out about auditions? Let's start with that. Like, how would somebody go about finding out about auditions?
Okay, so I think there's a variety of ways. There's no set way of doing this. I am a member of Spotlight, which you subscribe to as a performer. It is where people, companies, film companies, TV, theatre, they put up their jobs. Another platform that is quite prominent with sharing jobs that are coming up is Twitter.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, so I think particularly in this industry, a lot of work comes up on some social media stuff. So I think following companies that you enjoy the work of, like if you've gone out and seen companies that you go, oh, I really like what they do, that's really cool, following those guys, following regional theatres, following filmmakers, whatever it is, that quite often they'll put up call outs and dropping them an email.
Yeah.
Dropping them an email and introducing yourself. Hi, I'm Sophie. I'm a Hull-based actor. I'm really interested in the work that you're doing. I've got experience in this. If you could let me know if there's any opportunities coming up, because they might not have stuff at the minute when you're looking at it, but things will always come up. It just depends where they're at in their like production cycle, as it were. So yeah, just getting in touch with people, directors that you like, other actors as well. I think that's a great thing is speaking to that community, other actors, other performers.
And what's the initial kind of application process?
It can vary. So I think it depends on the project. It depends what they're requiring from you. Some people are literally like, just send us a headshot. Email us at this. So you'll take their email and you send your headshot across. Some people have an application process. So they'll want you to maybe write a little bit about why you're interested in being involved in this project, what experience you have, or what ideas you have. So you'll have to sort of spend a bit of time writing that, essentially like a cover letter, I guess.
Yeah.
And then other ones will require that and maybe a self-tape of some kind. A monologue or a song, they'll need to hear you sing, or it really depends on what you're going for.
So say you get offered an audition, and again I'm presuming this totally depends on the project that you're going for, but is there a kind of standard thing that happens within this, or is it completely different with the process?
From my experience, predominantly in theatre, it can really vary. So it's dependent again on what project you're going up for. But I will say each time they will tell you what they want. They'll tell you what they want you to see, what they want to see, what they want you to prepare. Sometimes people will send some sides across, so maybe a couple of bits of script, some scenes for you to have read through, and then in the audition they'll want you to read them, or sometimes people want you to learn them as well. So it's well worth spending a lot of time in your prep of familiarizing yourself with the text, with the context of the project and things. So you'll maybe have to read through some sides or perform a monologue you've prepared or something like that. You maybe have to do a song. Sometimes I have worked for people where it has been group auditions, so you're in the room somewhere and there are other actors auditioning with you. What you'll usually find is you'll be in front of the director, potentially the producer, and if there's singing and music, maybe a musical director in there, and potentially the writer. You don't normally get masses of people on a panel. If you're doing group auditions, then those are in with other actors who are also going for the job. Usually those group auditions are almost like workshops, so they'll set you with tasks, with devising something together or moving together or something like that. And I think with those ones, it's about seeing how you work and what you bring to a room as a team. They can feel quite scary, but I think the idea is to just see how you would work. I've had the privilege of being on the other side, being on the side where the directors are and people cast in a production. And something that's really stuck with me from doing that, and I think also if you ever speak to any other directors or people that are casting, we want you to do well. When you're stepping into that room, there's always a fear. There's always like, oh, I'm being judged, or this is really scary. But I think to remind yourself that everybody just wants to see you do a good job. The reason you've got an audition is because they think you're good. The audition is about, from their side, going, do you fit in the team that we're creating?
Is it always in person, or are you doing some now online since COVID's happened? Like, has that changed auditions a bit?
Yeah, so again, it varies, but I think since COVID, there's been an acknowledgement of, do we need to make you travel halfway across the country for this?
Yeah.
It depends what they're looking for and what they need, but the ability to do it on Zoom is can be really great. It saves on the cost of travel. If it's not like a group workshop audition, it's probably about 20 minutes.
Oh, that's good. That is helpful. With to hear with the cost of living crisis at the minute as well, that's a really helpful thing, isn't it? So
it really is. So I've done a variety of auditions recently that have been on Zoom. One thing when you're doing that, I would just make sure that you've got a good setup. That you've got good Wi-Fi, because the last thing you want is all the technology side to sort of fail you. Which makes it more stressful for you. So if you've got the ability to have a nice quiet space somewhere and your Wi-Fi is good, then you should be okay.
If there's a link between what these experts are saying, which I'd echo, is that no one interviewing you, whether for an HE course or a job, expects you to be the finished article. They just want to know your processes and how you operate. So don't be the thing that holds you back. You can do it. Thanks to all the people who've participated in the episode. And should you want to explore our resources further to discover the previous series of the HE Knowledge Hub podcast, go online to nextstepssw@plymouth.ac.uk or pop-humber.co.uk. You can follow both UniConnects on social at nextstepssw and Humber Outreach Programme. Thanks for listening.